four brass bands wander the rooms, blaring a cacophony of overlapping parade marches. I watched Marco and Gocha carefully all night, curious to see if this whole dating thing worked. They sat next to each other awkwardly. Their interaction consisted only of the necessary formalities of the evening, the menu, the service, the atmosphere. Ha ha, wasn't that funny when the waiter gave you my steak? The tension was killing me. It wasn't as if Marco was a natural. In grade school, he'd never been that popular, largely on account of being foreign, having the nickname Pumpkinhead, and joining the Young Republicans. By the time he had graduated, he was probably worse off than I was. At least I'd kissed a girl. In college, he began taking steps toward relations with the opposite sex. He purchased a leather jacket, invented an aristocratic background for himself, put Terence Trent D'Arby extensions in his hair, and bought his first Mercedes-Benz. The effort earned him some attention, even a few female friends. But it wasn't until junior year that he was finally comfortable enough around women to start removing clothes with them, thanks largely to a younger student he befriended, Dustin. The taste of those first small victories was so sweet that Marco stayed in college for 3 more years, basking in his hard-won popularity until the administration declined his application to enroll for a 7th year. One of Marco's more peculiar habits is that he takes hour-long showers every night. No one has ever come up with a plausible explanation of what he does in there, because nothing makes sense. Masturbating, for example, doesn't take that long. If you have any theories, please send them to manofstyle@gmail.com. And you won't be alone, because a lot of people have sent their theories in, and I still don't necessarily understand it. After watching Marco sit uselessly next to Gocha for an hour, I cracked. I grabbed my camera and ran Mystery's digital photo routine on the pair. I asked them to take a picture smiling, then one looking serious, and finally, a passionate picture, kissing, for example. Marco stuck his neck out toward her, chicken-like, and pecked. No, a real kiss, I insisted, concluding the routine as the two would-be betrothed's lips bumped in what was the clumsiest first kiss I had ever witnessed. After dinner, Mystery and I terrorized the two-room restaurant, dancing with the old men, performing magic tricks for the waiters, and flirting indiscriminately with the married women. When we returned to the table, glowing, Gocha's eyes met mine. For a moment, they seemed to sparkle, as if searching for something in my gaze. I could swear it was an IOI. That night, I was awoken by a warm body climbing under the covers. It was my turn to share the bed with Marco. But this wasn't Marco. It was a woman's body. I felt a pair of warm hands caress my newly shaven skull. Gocha? Shh, she said, and sucked my upper lip into her mouth. I pulled loose. But what about Marco? He's in the shower, she said. Did you and he... No, she said with a contempt that surprised me. Gocha and I had hit it off that night. So had Gocha and Mystery. She had made a pass at Mystery earlier, and he'd pretended not to notice. But it was harder not to notice her when she was in my bed, in my nostrils, in my mouth. Sure, she'd had a few drinks, but alcohol has never caused anyone to do something they didn't want to. It only enables them to do what they've always wanted but repressed. And right now, it looked like Gocha wanted to be with a man who possessed all 6 of the 5 characteristics of an alpha male. Logically, it's easy to say that it's wrong to sleep with a girl your friend is pursuing. But when her body is pressed against yours so submissively, and you can smell the conditioner in her hair, strawberry, and that storm cloud of passion created by her desire has begun gathering around the two of you, try saying no. It's just too... right there. I ran my hands beneath her hair and slowly dragged my fingernails upward along her scalp. A shiver of pleasure ran through her body. Our lips met, our tongues met, our chests met. I couldn't do this. I can't do this, I told her. Why? Because of Marco. Marco? She asked, as if she'd never heard the name before. He's sweet, but he's just a friend. Listen, I said. You should go. Marco will probably be out of the shower soon. 15 minutes later, Marco was out of the shower. I heard him and Gocha arguing in Serbian in the hallway. A door slammed. Marco walked wearily into the room and collapsed onto his half of the bed. "Well?" I asked. He was never one to show much emotion. "Well, I want to take Mystery's next workshop." Chapter 8. I couldn't bridge the fucking gap. There she was, my Bo Derek blonde with an MBA, sitting next to me on a couch at a cafe. Her thigh was grazing mine. She was playing with her hair, and I was wussing out. The great style, the apprentice Pua, whose magnetism was so strong that it made Marco look like an AFC to his own true love, was still too scared to kiss a girl. I had great opening game, but no follow-through. I should have taken care of the problem before Belgrade. But it was too late. I was blowing it. I was scared of rejection and of feeling uncomfortable afterward. Mystery, in the meantime, was getting along just fine with Natalia, who was 13 years his junior. They had nothing in common, not even a language. But there they were, sitting together. His legs were crossed, and he was leaning back, letting her work to get his attention. She was leaning into him, with her hand on his knee. I walked my date back to her house after coffee. Her parents weren't even home. All I had to say was, "Can I use the bathroom?" And I could have been upstairs. But my mouth wouldn't speak the words. Countless successful approaches had helped reduce my fear of social rejection and made me seem like a promising pickup artist to others. But inside, I knew I was just an approach artist. To become a Pua, there was a far more devastating mental obstacle I still needed to overcome. My fear of sexual rejection. In the course of my seduction research, I'd read Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. And I remembered how much work and persistence it had taken the aristocratic dandy Rodolphe Boulanger de la Huchette to get just a kiss from the unhappily married Madame Bovary. But once he persuaded her to submit the first time, it was all over. She was obsessed. One of the tragedies of modern life is that women as a whole do not hold a lot of power in society, despite all the advances made in the last century. Sexual choice, however, is one of the only areas where women are indisputably in control. It's not until they've made a choice and submitted to it that their relationship is inverted and the man is generally back in a position of power over her. Perhaps that is why women, to the frustration of men everywhere, are so cautious about saying yes. In order to excel at anything, there are always hurdles, obstacles, or challenges one must get past. It's what bodybuilders call the pain period. Those who push themselves and are willing to face pain, exhaustion, humiliation, rejection, or worse, are the ones who become champions. The rest are left on the sidelines. To seduce a woman successfully, to inspire her to take the risk of saying yes, I would have to grow some balls and be willing to leave my comfort zone. And it was by watching Mystery win over Natalia that I learned this lesson. "I just got a haircut," he told her as they left the cafe. "I have itchy hairs on my neck. I want to take a bath. Come wash me." Natalia, predictably, said that seemed like a bad idea. "Oh, okay," he told her. "I gotta get going because I need to take a bath. Bye." As he walked away, her face fell. The thought that she might never see him again seemed to flash through her mind. This is what Mystery called a false takeaway. He wasn't really leaving. He was just letting her think he was. Mystery took 5 steps, counting as he went, then turned around and said, "I've been living in a shitty apartment for the past week. I'm going to get a hotel room right there and take a bath." He pointed to the Hotel Moskva down the street. "You can come with me, or just get an email from me in 2 weeks when I return to Canada." Natalia hesitated for a moment, then followed him. And that's when I realized the mistake I'd been making my whole life. To get a woman, you have to be willing to risk losing her. Step 4. Disarm the obstacles. Chapter 1. Choose a dojo. There's Ross Jeffries and the School of Speed Seduction, where subliminal language patterns are used to get a girl aroused. Or Mystery and the Mystery Method, in which social dynamics are manipulated to snag the most desirable woman in a club. Or David D'Angelo and Double Your Dating, in which he advocates keeping the upper hand over a woman through a combination of humor and arrogance that he calls cocky funny. Or Gunwitch and Gunwitch Method, in which the only thing students have to do is project animalistic sexuality and escalate physical contact until the woman stops them. His crude motto, make the hoe say no. Or there's David X, David Shade, Rick H, Major Mark, and Juggler, the newest guru on the scene, who appeared online one day claiming he could pick up women better and faster than any other PUA simply by reading his grocery list. Then there are the inner circle teachers, like Steve P. and Rasputin, who reveal their techniques only to those they deem worthy. Yes, there are plenty of mentors to choose from, each with his own methods and disciples, each operating under the belief that his way is the way. And the giants do battle constantly, threatening, name-calling, debunking, competing. My goal was to feed from all of them. I've never been a true believer in anything. I've preferred to combine teaching and wisdom from various sources, find what applies to me, and discard what doesn't. The problem is that when you drink from the source of knowledge, there is a price, and that price is faith. Every single teacher wanted to know that he was the best, that his students were the most loyal, that the competition wasn't getting laid. Yet every single student wanted to absorb as much information from as many different experts as possible. It is a crisis that's specific, not to the community, but to humanity. Power is retained by attracting loyalty, and subjugation is guaranteed by giving it. Though I had enjoyed teaching in Belgrade, I didn't want followers. I wanted more teachers. I still had a lot to learn. I found that out when Extra Mass took me to a party at the Argyle Hotel on Sunset Boulevard. I was dressed rakishly in a black sport coat with long tails and a thin, shaped goatee. Extra Mask, meanwhile, looked better and more outrageous every time I saw him. He now had his hair cut and spiked into a 4-inch mohawk. At the party, I noticed a pair of heavily peacock twins sitting on a couch like alabaster statues. Though their well-coiffed hair and matching vintage dresses earned them plenty of admiring looks, the girls didn't say a word to anyone all night. Who are they? I asked Extra Mask, who was talking to a petite, moon-faced woman who seemed very interested in him. They're the Porcelain Twins, he said. They do a goth burlesque show together. They're also well-known groupies. They double-team band members. I've masturbated with my penis about them and blown spectacular loads. Introduce me. But I don't know them. That's okay. Introduce me anyway. Extra Mask walked over to the girls and said, this is Style. I shook their hands. They were surprisingly warm hands for girls who looked half dead. We were just having a discussion about magic spells, I told them. Do you think spells work? I knew this was the perfect opener because it was clear they believed in spells. For some reason, most girls who strip or otherwise exploit their sexuality for a living do. Then I transitioned into the ESP number guessing routine. Entertain us more, they cooed. I'd gone too far. I'm not a dancing monkey, I replied. Besides, I'm a guy. I need a few minutes to recharge. It was a line of mysteries. They laughed on cue. I'll tell you what, I continued. I've shown you a couple cool things. Why don't you teach me something? They had nothing to show me. I'm going to talk to some friends, I said. I'll give you 5 minutes to think of something. I wandered away and struck up a conversation with a cherubic little punk named Sandy. 10 minutes later, the twins approached. We have something to teach you, they said proudly. I actually hadn't planned on speaking to them again. I didn't think they'd come up with anything. But they stood there and taught me sign language for 5 minutes. IOI, indicator of interest. We sat down together and made small talk, which the Puas refer to somewhat disparagingly as fluffing. The girls were easy to tell apart, because one had chickenpox scars, and the other had punctures in her face from removed piercings. They were visiting from Portland and planned to fly home the next day. They told me about their striptease show, in which they dance on stage and simulate lovemaking together. As we talked, I realized they were just ordinary, insecure girls. That's why they've been so quiet. Most men make the mistake of believing that an attractive woman who doesn't talk to or acknowledge him is a bitch. Most of the time, however, she's just as shy or insecure as the less attractive women he's ignoring, if not more so. What made the Porcelain Twins different is that they tried to compensate for their inner plainness with outer ostentatiousness. They were just sweet girls looking for a friend, and now they had found one. As we exchanged numbers, I felt the window open, but I didn't know whether to go for one twin, the other, or both. I couldn't figure out how to separate them, but I didn't know what to do to seduce them simultaneously either. I was stuck. So I excused myself and went to find Sandy. As I talked to Sandy, she sidled up next to me. She seemed like she wanted something. Fortunately, since Belgrade, I'd broken the kissing barrier. It happened one night at the Standard while I was sitting with a recently divorced South African woman I had met. I told her she smelled good, and I sniffed her neck. Then I discussed how animals learn everything about one another from smells, and how we're evolutionarily wired to respond when someone smells us or pulls our hair. After pulling her hair, I discussed the most sensitive parts of the body, the crease on the underside of the elbow, and the skin on the side of the neck. Soon, I was biting her arm and teaching her how to bite my neck. By the time we were making out, I had realized the solution to my problem, baby steps. I had been trying to figure out a way to lunge at a girl for a kiss when I should have been slowly escalating physical contact toward a kiss while talking to keep her mind occupied. I shared this technique with the other guys in the community, and the evolution phase shift was born. It was my new favorite routine. I began the routine with Sandy. As soon as she started biting my neck, I pulled her into the bathroom to make out. I wasn't really attracted to her. I was just excited about being able to kiss women so easily now. I was already abusing my newfound power. When we emerged 10 minutes later, the twins had left the party. I'd blown it once again by taking the easy road rather than pushing myself. I returned to my apartment in Santa Monica empty-handed. Mystery was sleeping on my couch, and I told him about my failure with the twins. Fortunately, the next day, I received a message from the girls. Their plane had been canceled, and they were stuck at a Holiday Inn near the airport. I still had a chance to redeem myself. "What should I do?" I asked Mystery. "Invite yourself over. Just say, 'I'm coming over.' Don't give them any option. Then what happens when I'm in this weird hotel room with them? How do I get things started?" "Do what I always do. As soon as you walk in, run yourself a bath. Then take off your clothes, get in, call the girls in to scrub your back, and take it from there." "Wow, that's pretty ballsy." "Trust me," he said. So I called the twins back that evening and told them I was coming over. "We're just lying around in our sweats watching TV," they warned. "No problem. I haven't showered or shaved in a month." "Are you serious?" "No." So far, everything was going according to plan. I drove to the hotel, rehearsing every move in my head. When I walked in the room, they were lying on adjacent twin beds, watching The Simpsons. "I need to take a bath," I told them. "My hot water at home isn't working." "It's not lying, it's flirting." I made small talk while the water ran. Then I turned the corner into the bathroom, left the door open, removed my clothes, and sat in the tub. I didn't want to use soap yet because it would make the water dirty, so I sat naked in the bathwater, trying to work up the courage to call the girls in. I felt so vulnerable, sitting there pale, skinny, and naked. I needed to take Mystery's advice and start working out. A minute passed, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I could still hear The Simpsons coming from the television set. The girls probably thought I'd drowned by now. I had to make my move. I'd hate myself if I didn't. I sat there for 5 more minutes until I finally mustered the courage to stutter, "Hey, can you help me sort of wash my back?" One of the girls yelled something. There was silence, then whispering. I sat in the bathtub panicking, worried that they wouldn't even come in. What a dumb thing to say. The only thing more embarrassing would be if they actually came in and saw me sitting here naked with my dick floating in the water like a lily pad. I thought of my favorite line from Ulysses, when sexually frustrated Leopold Bloom imagines his impotent manhood in the bathwater and calls it the limp father of thousands. And then I thought, if I was smart enough to quote James Joyce in the bathtub, why did I feel so stupid in front of these girls? Finally, one of the twins walked in. I'd been hoping for both of them, but beggars can't be choosers. With my back to her, I reached over the side of the tub and handed her the soap. I was too embarrassed to look her in the eye. I straightened my spine so it didn't look too much like the dinosaur scales of Mr. Burns. She rubbed the soap in circles on my back. It wasn't erotic, it was workmanlike. I knew she wasn't turned on, and I hoped she wasn't grossed out. Then she wet the washcloth in the tub and wiped the soap off. My back was clean. Now what? I thought sex was supposed to automatically happen afterward, but she was just kneeling there, doing nothing. Mystery hadn't told me what I was supposed to do after asking them to wash my back. He'd just said, "Take it from there," so I assumed the whole sex thing would unfold organically. He hadn't told me how to transition from a back scrub to a hand job, and I had no idea. The last woman to wash my back was my mother, and that was when I was small enough to fit in the sink. But now was the moment. Something had to be done. "Thanks," I told her. She walked out of the bathroom. Fuck. I'd blown it. I finished washing myself, climbed out of the bath, toweled off, and put my dirty clothes back on. I sat on the edge of the bed of the girl who had washed me, and we talked. I decided to try to adapt the evolution phase shift pattern to a party of two. I told the other sister to sit on the bed with us. "You both smell so good," I began. Then I pulled their hair simultaneously and bit each of their necks, but it still didn't get anything going. They were both so passive. I had them each massage one of my hands as we talked about their stage show. I wasn't going to leave the room a failure. "You know what's funny?" one of them said. "We get all our physicality out on stage. We never even touch or hug each other in real life. We're probably more distant than most sisters." I left their hotel room a failure. On the way home, I stopped by Extramask's house, where he lived with his parents. "I'm confused," I told him. "I thought you said they did guys together." "Yeah, but I was just joking around. I thought you knew." We lay on the floor for 2 hours talking about the game and our progress. Since adolescence, whenever I'd had the opportunity to make a wish on an eyelash, a digital clock at 11:11, an ever-increasing number of birthday candles, thrown in with the usual pleas for world peace and personal happiness, I'd ask for the ability to attract any woman I wanted. I had fantasized about an incredible seductive energy entering my body like a lightning bolt. But instead, it was coming in a slow drizzle, and I was running around underneath it with a bucket, working to catch each drop. In life, people tend to wait for good things to come to them, and by waiting they miss out. Usually what you wish for doesn't fall in your lap. It falls somewhere nearby, and you have to recognize it, stand up, and put in the time and work it takes to get it. This isn't because the universe is cruel. It's because the universe is smart. It has its own cat string theory and knows we don't appreciate things that fall into our laps. I would have to pick up my bucket and work. So I took Mystery's advice. I got LASIK surgery, shedding my nerdy glasses once and for all. I paid to get my teeth laser whitened, and I joined a gym and took up surfing, which was not only a cardiovascular workout, but also a way to get tan. In some respects, surfing reminded me of sarging. Some days you go out and catch every wave and think you're a champ. Other days you don't get one good wave all day and think you suck. But no matter what, every day you go out and you learn and you improve. And that's what keeps you coming back. However, I hadn't joined the community just to get a makeover. I needed to complete my mental transformation, which I knew would be much more difficult. Before Belgrade, I had taught myself the words, skills, and body language of a man of charisma and quality. Now I needed to develop the inner strength, confidence, and self-worth to back it up. Otherwise, I'd just be a fake, and women would sense it instantly. I had 2 months off until my next workshop with Mystery in Miami, and I wanted to really blow away the students there. So I gave myself an assignment: to meet, in the next few months, every top pua there was. I planned to make myself a seducing machine, designed from pieces of all the best puas. And now that I had some status in the community as Mystery's new wing, it would be easy to meet them. Chapter 2. Shortly after my misadventure with the Porcelain Twins, I received a phone call from Ross Jeffries. "I'm having a workshop this weekend," he said. "If you want, you can come sit in for free. It's at the Marina Beach Marriott Hotel on Saturday and Sunday." "Sure," I told him. "I'd love to go. There's just one thing. You owe me parties. Good Hollywood parties with hot chicks. You promise me." "Got it. And before we hang up, you can wish me a happy birthday."
"It's your birthday?"
"Yes, your guru of gash is 44, and my youngest this year was 21. I had no idea he was inviting me to his seminar, not as a student, but as a conquest. I arrived on Saturday afternoon to find a standard hotel conference room, the kind that's so brightly lit and mustard yellow, it seems designed as a habitat more for salamanders than for human beings. Rows of men sat behind white rectangular tables, facing the front of the room. Some were greasy-haired students, others were greasy-haired adults, and a few were greasy-haired dignitaries, top-ranking officials at Fortune 500 companies, and even the Justice Department. In the front was our porous, bony guru of gash, talking into a headset. He was telling the students about the hypnotic technique of using quotes in a conversation. "Any idea is more palatable," he explained as he paced the room, "if it comes from someone else. The unconscious," he explained, "thinks in terms of content and structure. If you introduce a pattern with the words, 'my friend was telling me,' the critical part of her mind shuts off. Do you follow me?" He looked around the room for a response, and that was when he noticed me, sitting in the back row between Grimble and Two-Timer. He stopped speaking. I felt the heat of his glare on me. "Brothers, this is style." I smiled wanly. He has seen what Mystery has to offer, and decided to become my disciple. Isn't that right, style? Every greasy head in the room turned to look at me. I could feel the gravity that the name Style now held when he spoke it, the murmurs of excitement from his students. The reviews of Mystery's Belgrade workshop had hit the internet, and my skills in the field had been soundly praised. People were curious to meet Mystery's new wing, or, in Ross's case, to own him. I stared at the thin black headset coiling around his face like a spider. "Something like that," I said. That was not enough for him. "Who is your guru?" he asked. It was his room, but it was my mind. I didn't know what to say. Since the best way to deflect pressure is with humor, I tried to think of a joke response. I couldn't come up with one. "I'll get back to you on that," I answered. I could see that he wasn't happy with my response. After all, this wasn't just a seminar he was running. It was a cult. When the meeting broke for lunch, Ross pulled me aside. "Why don't you join me for some Italian?" he said, twirling his ring, a replica of the one worn by the superhero Green Lantern. "I wasn't aware that you were still a big supporter of Mystery," he said over lunch. "I thought you had come over to the good side of the Force." "I don't think your two methods have to be mutually exclusive. I told Mystery what you did with the waitress at California Pizza Kitchen, and he flipped out. I think for the first time he saw how speed seduction could really be effective." Ross's face turned purple. "Stop," he said. It was a hypnosis word, a pattern interrupt. "Do not share anything with him. I don't want that guy taking my best work, stealing it, and making money off it. This is disturbing." He stabbed a fork into his chicken. I knew something was wrong. If you're going to be this deeply involved with Mystery,
then I'm going to have a problem. If you're going to learn privately with me, I forbid you from telling him the details. Listen, I tried to appease the angry guru. I haven't told him anything in detail. I just let him know that you are the real deal. Fine then. Just tell him you saw me get a chick hot as hell and wetting her panties just by asking a couple of questions and making some gestures. Let the arrogant fuck figure it out for himself. I watched his nostrils flare and the veins in his forehead bulge as he spoke. He was clearly a guy who'd been beaten down early in life. Not by the brutality of his father like Mystery. Ross's parents were a smart, good-humored Jewish couple. I knew because they'd arrived at the seminar a few minutes after me and instantly started teasing him. Rather, Ross had been beaten down socially, which probably took a great toll on his psyche when combined with the constant teasing and high expectations of his parents. His siblings must have been overwhelmed as well. His two brothers had turned to God and become Jews for Jesus. As for Ross, he had turned to a religion of his own making. "You are being led into the inner sanctum of power, my young apprentice," he warned, wiping the gray stubble on his chin with the back of his hand. "And the price for betrayal is dark beyond measure of your mortal mind. Keep quiet and keep your promises, and I will keep opening the door." Ross's severity and anger, though unconscionable, were understandable. The fact was, Ross had built the seduction community almost single-handedly. Sure, there had always been a stable of men giving pickup advice, like Eric Weber, whose book How to Pick Up Girls helped start the trend that culminated in the movie The Pickup Artist with Molly Ringwald and Robert Downey Jr. But there had never been a community of guys before Ross. The reason was fortuitous timing. As speed seduction was developing, so was the internet. In his 20s, by all accounts, Jeffries was an angry man. His ambition was stand-up comedy and screenwriting. One of his scripts, They Still Call Me Bruce, was even produced, but it flopped. So Jeffries drifted between paralegal jobs, lonely and girlfriendless. That all changed when he was in the self-help section of a bookstore and his hand, he claims, involuntarily reached out and grabbed a book. That tome was Frogs into Princes, the classic book on NLP by John Grinder and Richard Bandler. Ross went on to devour every book on the subject he could find. One of his heroes had always been the Green Lantern, who was endowed with a magic ring able to bring the desires of his will and imagination to life. After using NLP to end a long streak of involuntary chastity by seducing a woman who'd applied for a job in the law office where he worked, Ross Jeffries believed he had found that ring. The power and control that had eluded him his whole life was finally his. His professional pickup career began with a small self-published book. The title pretty much summed up where he was coming from emotionally at the time. How to Get the Woman You Desire into Bed, a down-and-dirty guide to dating and seduction for the man who's fed up with being Mr. Nice Guy. He sold the book through small classified ads in the back of Playboy and Hustler. When he added seminars to his repertoire, he began marketing on the internet as well. One of his students, a legendary computer hacker named Louis DePayne, soon created the news group alt.seduction.fast. Out of that forum, an international cabal of pooas gradually came into being. "When I first came out with this stuff, I was savagely ridiculed," Ross said. "I was called every name in the book and accused of the worst things. I was really angry for a while, very pissed off. But gradually, the argument went from, is this real, to, should they be doing it?" And that is why every guru owes at least a pledge of allegiance to Ross Jeffries. He laid the groundwork. It's also why every time new teachers pop up, Ross tries to shoot them down. In a few cases, he has even threatened to reveal a young competitor's online seduction activities to his parents or school administration. Worse than Mystery, in his mind, was a former speed seduction student named David D'Angelo. Originally, D'Angelo called himself Sisonif, which is hypnosis spelled backward, and worked his way into the speed seduction hierarchy, where he helped Ross with marketing. But the two of them had a falling out when Ross supposedly hypnotized a girlfriend of D'Angelo's into having sex with him. According to Ross, D'Angelo had brought the girl to him to seduce. It wasn't uncommon, he said, for students to bring him women as a sacrifice of sorts. According to D'Angelo, Ross was in no way given permission to touch the girl. Whatever the case, the result was that the two stopped speaking, and D'Angelo set up a rival business called Double Your Dating. It was based not on NLP or any other form of hypnosis, but rather on evolutionary psychology and D'Angelo's principle of cocky funny. You know, my cheapjack imitator, David D. Anishole, is having his first seminar in LA this weekend, Ross said. The guy is so fucking good-looking and well-connected in the nightclub scene, it just astounds me that people think he could ever understand their situation and the difficulties they encounter in dealing with women. I made a mental note to sign up for the seminar. There's a certain view of women that David D. Anishole and Gun Bitch and Misery have, Ross continued, working himself into a rage. These guys are focusing on the worst tendencies of some of the worst women out there and spreading it like a cloud of fertilizer on all women. Ross reminded me of an old rhythm and blues artist who has been ripped off so much that he trusts no one. But at least there are publishing companies and copyrights in place to protect songwriters. There is no way to copyright a woman's arousal, to declare certain authorship over her choice of a partner. His paranoia, sadly, made sense. Especially when it came to Mystery, the only seducer with the ideas and skills to supplant him. The waiter cleared our pasta. I am so passionate about this because I care about these kids, Ross was saying. I think that 20% of my students have been abused. They have been severely impacted. Not just with women, but with all people, male and female. And a lot of problems in society come from the fact that we all have such strong drives, but live in a culture that discourages us from exploring them freely. He turned around and noticed three businesswomen eating dessert a few tables away. He was about to freely explore his sex drive. How's that berry cobbler? Ross yelled at them. Oh, it's good, one of the women replied. You know, Ross said to them, people have signal systems for dessert. He was off and running. The signals say, this is sugar-free, this melts in my mouth, and the signal system fires up your body's responsiveness to get ready for what comes next. It's tracing an energy flow through your body. He had the women's attention now. Really? They asked. I teach courses in energy flow, Ross told them. The women oohed in unison. The word energy is the equivalent of the smell of chocolate to women in Southern California. We were just talking about whether men really understand women, and we think we've figured it out. In a flash, he was at their table. As he spoke, the women forgot completely about their dessert and stared at him rapt. I couldn't tell sometimes if his patterns really worked on the sophisticated subconscious level he claimed, or if most conversations were so boring that simply saying something different and intriguing was enough to trigger attraction. Oh my God, one of the women said when he finished running a pattern about the qualities women look for in a man. I've never heard it said like that before. Where do you teach? I'd love to know more. Ross collected her phone number and returned to the table. He turned to me, smiled, and said, now do you see who's teaching the true way? Then he rubbed his thumb on his chin. Chapter 3. Attraction isn't a choice. Those were the words David D'Angelo had projected on the wall. The seminar was packed. There were more than 150 people in the room. Many of them I recognized from other seminars, including Extra Mask. It was getting to be an all-too-familiar sight. A person on stage with a headset instructing a group of needy men on how to save themselves from nightly onanism. But there was a difference. D'Angelo was a good-looking guy, like Ross Jeffries had said. He reminded me of Robert De Niro, if De Niro had been a mama's boy who'd never been in a fight in his life. D'Angelo stood out from the other gurus precisely because he didn't stand out. He wasn't charismatic or interesting. He didn't have the crazy gleam of a wannabe cult leader or some gaping hole in his soul that he was trying to fill with women. He didn't even claim to be good at the game. He was very ordinary, but he was dangerous, because he was organized. He had clearly spent months working on his seminar. It was not only entirely scripted, but cleaned up for mass consumption. It was a school of pickup instruction that could be presented to the mainstream without shocking anyone with its crudeness, its attitude toward women, or the deviousness of its techniques. Except, that is, for his recommendation of reading the book Dog Training by Lou Burke for tips on handling girls. D'Angelo was a bright guy and a threat to Ross. Many of the speakers at his seminar were, like himself, Ross's former students. Among them, Rick H., Vision, and Orion, an Uber nerd who was famous as the first PUA to sell videotapes of himself approaching girls on the street. This video series, Magical Connections, was considered hard evidence that nerds with hypnosis skills could get laid. Seduction, D'Angelo read from his notes, is defined in the dictionary as an enticement to wrongdoing, specifically the offense of inducing a woman to consent to unlawful sexual intercourse by enticements which overcome her scruples. In other words, he continued, seduction implies tricking, being dishonest, and hiding your motives. That is not what I am teaching. I'm teaching something called attraction. Attraction is working on yourself and improving yourself to the point where women are magnetically attracted to you and want to be around you. Not once did D'Angelo mention the names of his competitors and rivals. He was too smart for that. He was going to try to take this whole underground world up for air, and he was going to do it by not acknowledging the underground world at all. He had stopped posting online and instead hired others to stick up for him when he was flamed. He wasn't a genius or an innovator like Mystery and Ross, but he was a great marketer. "How do you make someone want something?" he asked, after making his students practice giving each other James Dean underlooks. "You give it value. You show that others like it. You make it scarce, and you make them work for it. I want you to think about other ways during lunch." I joined D'Angelo and some of his other students for a burger and found out a little more about him. A struggling real estate agent from Eugene, Oregon, he moved to San Diego for a fresh start. Lonely, he yearned to cross that invisible barrier separating two strangers at a club. So he began searching the web for tips and cultivating friends who were good with women. One of those friends was Riker, a Ross Jeffries protege who turned him onto using America Online to meet women. Sending instant messages was a way for D'Angelo to practice flirting the way his new player friends did, but without risking public embarrassment. "That was the chi," he said, as students milled about awkwardly, trying to overhear. "I was learning new ideas, implementing them, and then noticing how women responded on America Online. That's when I learned that busting women's balls and really slamming them immediately didn't have the effect that the intuitive mind would guess it would. So I became cocky and funny. I stole their lines, I teased them, I accused them of hitting on me, and I never gave them a break." Flush with his new findings, D'Angelo delivered a 15-page screed to Cliff's List, one of the oldest and most established online seduction newsletters. The then-nascent seduction community ate it up. A new guru had arrived. Cliff, the middle-aged Canadian businessman who ran the list by day and hunted for new master puas to bring into the community by night, helped convince D'Angelo to spend 3 weeks turning his manifesto into an ebook, Double Your Dating. The highlight of the seminar was an appearance by two people who would give me my much-coveted inner game and more, Steve P. and Rasputin. These were guys I'd heard whispered about in the seduction community since I'd joined, the true masters, leaders of women, not men. The first thing they did when they walked on stage was hypnotize everybody in the room. They both talked at the same time, telling different stories, one to occupy the conscious mind and the other to penetrate to the subconscious. When they woke us up, we had no idea what they had installed in our heads. All we knew was that these were two of the most confident speakers we'd ever seen. Every ounce of fire and charisma that D'Angelo lacked, they possessed in bulk. Wearing a leather vest and an Indiana Jones hat, Steve P. was equal parts Hell's Angel and Native American shaman. Rasputin was a strip club bouncer with mutton chop sideburns who looked like a steroid-jacked Wolverine. The two had met in a bookstore while both reaching for the same NLP book. Now they worked as a team and were among the most powerful hypnotists in the world. Their advice on seducing women was simply, become an expert in how to feel good. Toward that end, Steve P. had figured out a way to get women to pay to have sex with him. For anywhere from several hundred to $1,000, he trained women to have orgasms from a single vocal command. He taught them three different stages of deep throat he had devised, and most fantastically, he claimed to give hypnotic breast enlargements, which he said could make a woman jump as much as two cup sizes. Rasputin's forte was what he called hypnotic sexual engineering. Sex, he explained, must be viewed as a privilege for the woman, not a favor to you. If a woman wants to give me a blowjob, he elaborated, I tell her, you only get three sucks, and you may only go down as far as you receive pleasure. His chest stuck out like the top of a Volkswagen. Afterward, I tell her, didn't that feel nice? Next time you get five sucks. Afterward, D'Angelo introduced me to the pair. The top of my head came up to Rasputin's Volkswagen. I'd love to learn more about what you do, I said. You're nervous, Rasputin said. Well, you two are a little intimidating. Let me get rid of that anxiety, Steve offered. Tell me your phone number backward. I started saying 5, 4, 9, 6. As I did, Steve snapped his fingers. Okay, take a deep breath and now blow out hard, he commanded. As I did, Steve traced his fingers up from my navel and made a whooshing sound. Be gone, he commanded. Now watch that feeling just blow away like a smoke ring on a windy day. Notice how it's gone. It's no more. Take a tour of your body and try and find where it was, and notice how there's a different vibration there. Okay, open your eyes. Try really hard to bring any piece of it back. See? You can't. I couldn't tell whether it had worked or not, but I was reeling. He'd definitely taken my mind and body on some kind of one-minute trip. He took a step back and scanned my face, as if reading a diary. A guy named Phoenix offered to pay me $2,000 to follow me around for 3 days, Steve P. said. And I told him no, because he wants to make women his slaves. You seem like you may care about women. You don't just want to stuff your meat bat in some hole. You're willing to explore shit. Suddenly, we heard a commotion behind us. Two sisters and their mother had made the mistake of walking down a hallway full of pickup artists, and the vultures were descending on the carrion. Orion, the Uber nerd, was reading one of the girls' palms. Rick H. was telling the mother that he was Orion's manager. Grimble was moving in on the remaining girl, and a crowd of wannabe puas had gathered around, trying to see the masters at work. Listen, Steve P. said in a rush. Here's my card. Call me if you ever want to learn some inner circle shit. I'd love to. But this is classified, he warned. If we let you in, you cannot share these techniques with anybody. They're very powerful, and in the wrong hands, they could really screw a girl up. Got it, I said. He twisted a piece of white paper in his hand into the shape of a rose, then bounded off in the direction of the carrion. He approached the girl Grimble was sarging, told her to smell the flower, and within 30 seconds, she was passed out in Steve's arms. This was inner circle shit, and I was about to learn it. Chapter 4. And so began the weirdest phase of my education. Every weekend, I drive 2 hours south to San Diego and stay at Steve P.'s small, squalid apartment, where he raised two sons the same way he talked to his students, with compassionate obscenity. His 13-year-old was already a better hypnotist than I would ever be. In the afternoons, Steve and I drove to see Rasputin. They'd sit me in a chair and ask what I wanted to learn. I had a list. To believe that I was attractive to women, to live in my own reality, to stop worrying about what other people thought of me, to move and speak with an air of strength, confidence, mystery, and depth. to get over my fear of sexual rejection, and, of course, to attain a sense of worthiness, which Rasputin defined as the belief that one deserves the best the world has to offer. It was easy to memorize routines, but mastering inner game after a lifetime of bad habits and thought patterns was not easy. These guys, however, had the tools to fix me in time for Mystery's next workshop in Miami. "We're going to reframe you to where you're not glad to have some boopsie sucking your dick," Steve explained. "It will be a privilege for her to get to drink from the nectar of the master." At each session, they'd put me under, and Rasputin would tell complex metaphorical stories into one of my ears, as Steve P. issued commands to my subconscious in the other ear. They'd leave open loops, or unfinished metaphors and stories, in my mind that they'd close a week later. They'd play music designed to elicit specific psychological reactions. They'd put me into trances so deep that hours went by in the blink of an eye. Afterward, I'd go back to Steve's house and read his NLP books while he screamed at his kids. I have a theory that most naturals, like Dustin, lose their virginity at a young age and consequently never feel a sense of urgency, curiosity, and intimidation around women during their critical pubescent years. Those who must learn to meet women methodically, on the other hand, like myself and most students in the community, generally suffer through high school without girlfriends or even dates. Thus, we're forced to spend years feeling intimidated by and alienated from women who hold in their sole possession the key to releasing us from the stigma blighting our young adult lives, our virginity. Steve fit in with my theory on naturals. He was initiated into sex when he was in first grade. An older girl wanted to give him a blowjob. He responded by trying to hit her with a rock. But eventually she convinced him, and the experience set off a lifelong obsession with oral sex. When he was 17, he said, a cousin hired him to work in the kitchen of a Catholic girls' school. After he gave oral sex to one of the girls, word spread, and he soon became the sexual go-to guy on campus. In addition to giving the girls pleasure, however, he also gave them guilt. And after a few too many confessions that involved the boy in the kitchen, Steve was fired. He ran with a bike gang for a while, but left soon after accidentally shooting a guy in the nuts. He now devoted his life to a self-styled mix of sexuality and spirituality. And for all his crude talk, he was at heart a good person. Unlike many of the other gurus I'd met, I trusted him. When Steve's kids went to sleep each night, he taught me inner circle magic he'd learned from shamans whose names he'd sworn never to pronounce. The first weekend I stayed over, he gave me a lesson in soul gazing, which is when you look deep into a woman's right eye with your own right eye as you breathe together. "Once you do this with her, she's going to bond real strong with you," he warned. His cautionary speeches were often longer than the actual teaching process. "When you do this, you become Anamkara, which in Gaelic means friend of the soul, a soul friend." The following weekend, I learned about menage a trois management and how to train a woman to eat another woman's pussy by having her put a dried nectarine in her mouth and chew erotically on it during sex. The next weekend, he showed me how to throw chi through my hands into a woman's abdomen. And the next weekend, he taught me to contain and cycle orgasmic energy so that a woman can stack one withheld orgasm on top of another until, as Steve P. put it, she's shaking like a dog shitting peach seeds. Finally, he shared what he considered to be his greatest skill, guiding any woman through words and touch to a powerful orgasm that gushes like Niagara Falls. This was a whole new level of game. He was giving me superpowers. I was in a whirlwind of learning. I didn't call my friends. I barely talked to my family. I turned down every writing assignment that came my way. I was living in an alternate reality. "I told Rasputin," Steve said one night, "that more than all the other seduction boys out there, I'd like you to become one of our trainers." It was an offer I'd have to turn down. The seduction world was a palace of open doors. Walking through one, no matter how tempting the treasures inside, would mean having to shut the rest. Besides, by this point, I'd realized something.
I didn't need to meet any more gurus. I had every piece of information I needed to become the greatest pickup artist in the world. I had hundreds of openers, routines, cocky funny comments, ways to demonstrate value, and powerful sexual techniques. And I'd been hypnotized to Valhalla and back. It wasn't necessary to learn anything else, unless it was for my own fun and interest. I just needed to be in the field constantly, approaching, calibrating, fine-tuning, and working through my sticking points. I was ready for Miami and all the workshops to follow. As I drove home from Steve P's house for the last time, I made a promise to myself. If I ever met a guru again, it would be not as a student, but as an equal. Step 5. Isolate the target. Chapter 1. As Mystery and I traveled the world doing workshops, meeting all the players in the game, the seduction community became more than just a bunch of anonymous screen names. It became a flesh and blood family. Mad Dash was no longer seven letters of type, but a funny, Jeremy Piven-like entrepreneur from Chicago. Stripped was an uptight book editor from Amsterdam with male model looks. Nightlight 9 was a lovable nerd who worked for Microsoft. Over time, the posers and keyboard jockeys were outed, and the superstars were given their due. And Mystery and I were the superstars, because we delivered. Miami, Los Angeles, New York, Toronto, Montreal, San Francisco, and Chicago. Every workshop made us better, stronger, more driven. All the other gurus I had met clung to the safety of the seminar room. They had never been forced to prove their teachings in the field, city after city, night after night, woman after woman. Every time we left a city, a lair sprung up if one didn't exist already, bringing together students eager to practice their new skills. Through word of mouth, the lair soon doubled, tripled, and quadrupled in size. And all these guys worshipped Mystery and style. We were living the life they wanted, or so they thought. Each workshop generated more online reviews, praising my newly acquired game. Each field report I posted triggered a flood of emails from students wanting to be my wing. The list of sergers in my phone book was actually starting to surpass the number of girls I'd met. Most of the time, when my phone rang, it was a guy asking for style. And, dispensing with introductions, he'd ask, "When you call a girl, should you block your number or not?" Or, "I was in a three set, and the obstacle ended up liking me and giving me her phone number. Do I still have a chance with the target?" Since I'd started spending so much time with PUAs, I'd lowered my standards for people I hung out with. All my old friends had fallen by the wayside. Now my social life was monopolized by a caliber of nerd I'd never associated with before. But it was worth it, because it was part of the process of becoming that guy in the club. The one I'd always envied. The one in the corner making out with a girl he'd just met. The Dustin. Before I discovered the community, the only time I'd ever made out with a girl I met in a club was when I first arrived in Los Angeles. But in the middle of kissing, she pulled away and said, "Everyone must think you're a producer or something." The subtext was that she was otherwise too hot to be making out with a slob like myself. It shattered me for months. I was too insecure to handle what was, in retrospect, her own form of neg. But now, when I walked into a club, I felt a rush of power, wondering which woman would have her tongue down my throat within half an hour. For all the self-improvement books I'd read, I still wasn't above shallow validation seeking. None of us were. That's why we were in the game. Sex wasn't about getting our rocks off. It was about being accepted. Mystery, in the meantime, had gone through his own metamorphosis during our travels. He had developed a radical new form of peacocking. It was no longer enough to wear just one item to catch the attention of the opposite sex. Now, all his items were larger than life, turning Mystery himself into a mobile sideshow. He wore 6-inch platform boots and a bright red tiger-striped cowboy hat, which combined to make him 7 feet tall. He added skin-tight black PVC pants, futuristic goggles, a plastic-spiked backpack, a mesh see-through shirt, black eyeliner, white eyeshadow, and as many as 7 watches on his wrists.
every head turned as he walked down the street. He didn't need openers. The women opened him. Girls followed him for blocks. Some grabbed his ass. One older woman even bit his crotch. And all he had to do if he was interested was perform a few magic tricks, which seemed to justify his outlandishness. His new look also served as a great litmus test for women. It repelled the type of girl he wasn't interested in and attracted the type he was. I'm dressing for the outrageous club girls, the hot, slutty girls, the ones I could never get, he explained one night when I accused him of looking like a clown. They're playing groupie, so I gotta play rock star. Mystery constantly encouraged me to dress as outlandishly as he did. Though I buckled one afternoon and bought a purple fur vest in a Montreal lingerie shop, I didn't get off on the constant gawking and attention. Besides, I was doing well enough without it. My reputation stemmed largely from the Miami workshop, where in a period of 30 minutes, I put my previous 6 weeks of hypnosis, training, and guru chasing into action. It was a night that would go down in the annals of community history. It was seduction not as wrestling, but as ballet, a perfect example of form. It was the night of my official graduation from AFC to PUA. Chapter 2. It was the perfect Sarge. When they walked into the VIP area of Miami's Crowbar, everyone noticed. They were both platinum blondes with well-tanned fake breasts and identical outfits, tight white tank tops and tight white pants. How could anyone not notice? They were what most PUAs would call perfect tens, and they were dressed to turn men into beasts. This was South Beach, where testosterone levels run high, and the pair had been whistled and hollered at all night. The girls seemed to enjoy the attention almost as much as they savored shooting down the men who gave it to them. I knew what to do, and that was to do what everyone else wasn't doing. A pickup artist must be the exception to the rule. I had to suppress every evolutionary instinct inside me and pay them no attention whatsoever. With me were Mystery and two of our students, Outbreak and the Matador of Love. The rest of our pupils were sarging on the perimeter of the dance floor downstairs. Outbreak went in first, complimenting the platinum twins on their outfits. They brushed him off like a gnat. Next, the Matador of Love moved in with the Maury Povich opener. He too crashed and burned. Now it was my turn. This was going to take every bit of confidence and self-esteem that Steve P. and Rasputin had hypnotized into me. If I showed even a flicker of weakness or doubt, they'd eat me alive. That tall one isn't a 10, Mystery leaned in and whispered to me. She's an 11. This is going to take some hardcore negging. The girls strolled to the bar, where they began talking to a transvestite in a black tutu. I moved in, not even glancing at them, and greeted the transvestite as if I knew him. I asked if he worked at the club, and he said no. It didn't really matter what I said to him. I was just maneuvering into position, pawning him for the two set. Now that I was in range, it was time to neg. That girl over there is biting your style, I said to the 10, the shorter of the two. Look at her. I pointed to another platinum blonde in a white outfit. She's just got the same hair, the 10 replied, dismissively. No, look at her outfit, I persisted. It's almost the exact same. They looked over, and here was the make-or-break moment. If I didn't come up with something good to follow, I'd lose their interest and be branded just another weirdo. So I continued with the negging. You know what? I told them. You both look like strange little snowflakes. It was a bizarre, cryptic comment, but now I had their attention. I could sense it, and my heart began to pump faster. I continued with what I knew all along would be my true opener. I have to ask you something. Is your hair real? The 10 looked shocked, then recovered her composure. Yes, she said, feel it. I pulled it gently. Hey, it moved. It's not real. Pull harder. I complied and yanked it so hard that her neck jerked back. Okay, I said. I believe you. But how about your friend there? The Eleven's face reddened. She leaned over the bar and looked me hard in the eye. "That is really rude. What if I'm bald underneath here? That could really hurt someone's feelings. It's disrespectful. How would you feel if someone said that to you?" The pickup is a high-stakes game, and to win, you have to play hard. All I had done so far was commandeer their attention and provoke an emotional reaction. Sure, it was a negative one, but now we had a relationship. If I could turn her anger around, I'd be in. Fortunately, I happened to be trying to make a point to the students and was wearing a black mod wig and a fake lip piercing, just to show that looks don't matter. It's all game. I leaned over the bar and stared the Eleven down. "Well," I told her, "I actually am wearing a wig, and I am bald underneath here." I paused, and she looked at me with her mouth open. She didn't know how to respond. Now it was time to reel her in. And I'll tell you something else. Whether I go out totally bald in this wig or in some crazy long-haired wig, it doesn't change the way I'm treated by other people. It's all your attitude. Don't you agree? Everything I say in a pickup has an ulterior motive. I needed to let her know that, unlike every other guy in the bar, I am not and will not be intimidated by her looks. Beauty to me now was a shit test. It weeded out the losers who got dumbstruck by it. "I live in Los Angeles," I continued. "It's where the most beautiful women in the country come to try and make it. You look around a club there, and everyone's good-looking. It makes this VIP room look like a dive bar." They were words I'd learned almost verbatim from Ross Jeffries, and they were working. I let her look around, then continued. "And do you know what I've learned? Beauty is common. It's something you're born with or you pay for. What counts is what you make of yourself. What counts is a great outlook and a great personality." Now I was in. It was the girls who were dumbstruck now, not me. I had entered their world, as Jeffries once put it to me, and demonstrated authority over it. And, to ensure my position there, I threw in one more neg, but softened with a slight compliment, as if they were winning me over. "And you know what? You have a great smile. I can tell that underneath all that, you're probably a good person." The 10 sidled up to me and said, "We're sisters." A lesser pickup artist would have thought that his work was done, that he had won them over. But no, this was just one more shit test. I looked very slowly at both of them and then took a chance. "Bullshit," I said, smiling. "I bet a lot of guys believe you, but I'm a very intuitive person. When I look at you both, I can tell you're very different. Too different." The 10 broke into a guilty smile. "We never tell anyone this," she said, "but you're right. We're just friends." Now I'd broken through her programming, moved her away from the autopilot responses she gives to men, and demonstrated that I was not just another guy. I took another chance, and I'd be willing to bet that you haven't even been friends for that long. Usually best friends start to have the same mannerisms, and you two don't really. "We've only known each other a year," the 10 admitted. Now it was time to back off my game and fluff a little. However, I made sure never to ask questions. Instead, as Juggler had taught me, I made open-ended statements that led them to ask me the questions. The 10 told me they were from San Diego, so we fluffed for a while about the West Coast and Miami. As we talked, I kept my back to the 11, as if I were less interested in her. This was classic mystery method. I wanted her thinking more about me, wondering why I wasn't giving her the attention she was so used to. Nothing in the game is an accident. I think of a woman's interest in me as a fire, and when it starts to die out, it's time to turn around and stoke it. So just when the 11 was about to walk away to find someone to talk to, I turned around and delivered a beautiful line. "You know what? When I look at you, I can see exactly what you looked like in middle school. And I'm willing to bet you weren't so outgoing or popular then." Sure, it was a truism, but she stared at me flabbergasted, wondering how I could possibly know that. To seal the victory, I laid out one last beauty-neutralizing, cold-reading routine. "I bet a lot of people think you're a bitch. But you're not. You're actually shy in a lot of ways. She began to give me the doggy dinner bowl look, as the Puas call it. It is the look that is the goal of any approach. Her eyes glazed over, her pupils dilated, and she just watched my lips move, entranced and attracted. I noticed, however, that the more interested the 11 became, the more kino the 10 gave me. Kino, in the Pua lexicon, being a word for touch. "You're interesting," the 10 gushed, pressing her breasts against me. I could see mystery, outbreak, and the matador of love rooting me on in the background. "We have to hang out with you in L.A." She leaned in and gave me a tight hug. "Hey, that'll be $30, I told her, disentangling myself. "This shit ain't for free." The more you push them away, the more they run toward you. "I love him," she told her friend. Then she asked if she and her friend could stay with me next time they were in L.A. "Sure," I said, but as the words left my mouth, I realized, too late, that I should have made my hospitality more of a challenge. There's so much to remember and juggle during a pickup that it is hard to get everything perfect. But no matter. She gave me her phone number, and I gave her mine. You may have noticed that I haven't been referring to these girls by their names. That's because I never introduce myself during a pickup. As Mystery had taught me on that first workshop, I wait for the woman to introduce herself or ask for my name. That way, I know she's interested. So, as we exchanged numbers, I received